My paper is not nearly so theoretical. But you know, I sort of struggled, and we had long conversations about what I would write for this. And one of the original ideas had been to connect all of these things to contemporary issues in Kentucky, which ultimately we decided not to do because we've done that, right? Because the connection famous is better. And then I thought also about writing, particularly about coal or the energy economy in Kentucky, because I'm very fascinated by that, and that is obviously one of those big things that would have jumped out. And one of the things that fascinated me from a tangent from my book that needs exploring a little bit more. So that's how I ended up here with James Jennings. It's also, the paper is itself pretty standard and pretty narrative, which is the style I like to write in, but it's also thinking about how we take the sort of snapshots that we see of people's lives here and how we supplement those with resources from other archives in ways that you all have done, of course, but to think about how we can connect this thing that is regional and is local and is state to bigger networks across the South and across the world too. And you know, this is something that we struggle in our messaging as we're pitching to grants and everything else, and saying that while all of these things have ultimately to do with Kentucky, and they should have passed a desk here in Frankfort. Sometimes some of them even down on that desk downstairs. We really are able to touch any number of points if you think creatively. But that ultimately, what you're going to see here is pretty limited, and so we need to supplement that with resources from elsewhere. So, with the exception of the tax records from Hancock County that I used to look into Mr. Jennings' coal holdings in the late 50s and early 60s, everything here came out of digital archive, not here. So that is sort of a testament to the things that Ed was talking about last night, right? The where we are now, where you can pretty quickly and without not too much particular effort assemble a really rich story there. So I'll jump into the and briefly narrate the story of James Jennings. One of my interests is the ways that people in Kentucky connect with the capital networks of the Cotton Southwest. Kentuckians are always moving westward, and have been since I mentioned this last night. But you know, our Confederate governor George Johnson, one of these elite families, who is the core of this very biased original archive that KH has built out from, the first half of his archival collection over there in the library is correspondence with his son-in-law sending him out to go buy new cotton land in Arkansas. Yet they live as Kentuckians. They live in Georgetown. He becomes the governor of Confederate Kentucky. All of his interests are with the Deep South. So I think this has an influence on the question of secession. And so merging that idea about these southwestern capital networks with that interest in coal and energy, I found this guy James Jennings, and we use this the document that I lead with, where the Adjutant General of Indiana is writing to Governor Bramlin, or it actually just CCs Bramlin on something he's sending to a Union Army commander in the southern part of the state, that basically says, look, keep your guerrillas on your side of the river, or we're gonna have to send some troops down there. Don't make me come down there. Get your stuff in order, and which we have seen is increasingly in the summer of 1864, pretty damn difficult to do. And so we use that as this fantastic sort of discussion of, and it talks about how these guerrillas along these border counties downriver from Louisville are in contact with copperhead networks in Indiana, are smuggling horses across the river and using them to support this guerrilla insurgency. What they don't understand is all of the local context there, and this is a theme that I've written about elsewhere, is that you know, Union troops don't understand the shades of political loyalty here in Kentucky, and they don't. And this is, my God, we see in Iraq and Afghanistan. If you don't understand all of the political and local and family alliances that happen in a place, how can you hope to govern it and occupy it and bring peace to it and control this irregular So the naval officer who's tasked with defending the entire Ohio River from West Virginia to the mouth or the confluence with Mississippi is this guy named Leroy Fish. He has 7 gunboats. They patrol ceaselessly up and down the river, and Fitch has apparently allowed this man named James Jennings a free pass to carry on river commerce, and the Indiana authorities think he's the one who's the active agent in this smuggling. So I wanted to find out who James was. We used this in a grant application. I think we published it in the Register as well, and we were publishing some sample documents. So we had, thinking sort of administratively for this project, we had used it for some of our grants before, but we really dug into Jennings this time. Come to find out, he is not a native Kentuckian and had only been here for a few years by the time the war started. And I have a feeling that as he's sort of constantly chasing the next market opportunity throughout his life in the late 40s and 50s, had the war not come, he would have left Kentucky pretty soon thereafter and gone off and found some other way to plug in to some sort of larger capital scheme. He's from Virginia. He and his brother moved to New Orleans, where his brother marries incredibly well into a family named the Hennons, who are some of the first Anglo lawyers to come down. And sort of set up shop in New Orleans. His brother's become the U.S. District Court clerk, which puts him in contact with a lot of very fascinating people. And then the two brothers start buying land. Eventually, James Jennings becomes a shipping agent and is running boats out of his New Orleans office to Boston, Liverpool, Glasgow, Havana, Panama, San Francisco. Sort of all the spots that we know to look for now. Because of this work on where cotton goes internationally. They own sugar plantations in Louisiana. They own cotton land in Galveston. They're sort of set up. And so James Jennings, as the one who is not particularly well established, sees another market opportunity in Hancock County, Kentucky, where there is some coal seams just sort of cropping out of the hill right above the river. And you can pretty easily, with a pretty low capital investment, get some Irish guys. Who can chip away at it, build a very cheap railroad track that's drawn with mules, and they can draw that coal up the hill, and you just push it down, and it goes right down to the river, and it's this coaling stop. But not only are they coaling boats which have come down from Louisville, but they're overloading them, and Jennings is sending the coal down to New Orleans, where his brother picks it up, puts it on transatlantic steamers, and they're subsidizing their cotton, getting their cotton to market cheaper than anybody else because they're mining the coal themselves that's fueling the steamships, right? So Kentucky coal doing this. Hancock County is at this time sort of a coal boom town, but a lot of people realize this is a possibility at the time. And then another set of investors over in Indiana has tried to set up a sort of rival to Lowell that is using this coal seam to set up this massive cotton textile mill, import cotton up the rivers from Mississippi and then back up the Ohio to Canada and Indiana and manufacture textiles and then send the produced goods back down. And they don't rival Lowell. But they do pretty well for themselves, and the thing hangs on until like the 30s, fueled by this coal, and so they're closely intertwined there. Long story short, when the war comes, Jennings just sort of sits tight, and he makes an absolute killing coaling up for the Union Army, or for the Union Navy. And things seem to be going pretty well until the guerrilla war comes in, and a racist Union veteran named Bill Davison, who left the army in protest of emancipation, but also because he was drunk and he was getting prosecuted for being drunk on duty, comes back home, forms a guerrilla band of maybe former Union veterans, but also maybe some guys who have just hung around, and Hancock County sort of develops this three-way war between conventional Confederate cavalry who are in town, the guerrillas who blow up everything in sight, including Jennings' coal mines, and the Union Navy, which occasionally will come in when one of the boats is in range and wild a few 24-pound ships into town to break everything up. And Jennings is more or less ruined by this, right? He doesn't make that next hop that he would have before, if had the war not come, because his prospects more or less have dried up. He sticks around. I'm pretty sure that the guy who owns a textile mill buys up most of the coal mines around there, probably buys Jennings out, they're pretty good friends. And Jennings stays there as a coal merchant. He coals up boats as they come down, and then he dies. His sons, however, continue this legacy, and this is something I'm really fascinated by as well. They end up both going to Harvard and studying under a Kentucky geologist named N.S. Shaler, a former Union veteran, incredibly dissatisfied with the results of the war, but is a brilliant mine engineer. And the two Jennings boys go off into South Africa and make an absolute killing in gold and diamond mining. Going into the family business, right? Finding ways to exploit racialized labor and work in mining. But unlike Jennings, the strength of Victoria's empire is greater than that of the United States, and they're able to cash out. And thinking now about legacies, there is still I forget the kid's name, but a Jennings scholarship given by the Harvard Engineering School to this day, right? Still based on that. We're just sort of thinking about the long impact and reaches.